Hello everyone, welcome to the Wellwood podcast. Today I'm talking to Ferdinand Götze, am I saying that right? From he's the head of growth or chief growth officer at Recruity. And I'm going to ask him, first of all, who he is. Who are you, Ferdinand, and where do you come from and how did you get here?
Oh, well, first of all, thanks for having me on the podcast.
Welcome.
It's a real pleasure. I am currently the chief growth officer at Recruity. A few weeks, I'll be starting as the Director of Marketing and Growth at a company called 3D Hubs. And I've been active in various aspects and forms of marketing for almost 10 years. Because when I was a teenager, I started with Black Hat SEO and web design.
Just like me.
I come from quite a mixed background, but I grew up largely in Budapest,
right,
in Hungary. I moved there in 99. And when I was 15, I wanted to get a job, and job prospects for a pretty mediocre to non-Hungarian speaker in his teen years were not...
Because you came from Germany.
I moved from England,
to
Hungary, but yeah, my family is part German. But yeah, it was difficult to find, it was difficult to get a job as a teenager at the time, especially because I didn't speak Hungarian so well. So I worked, thanks to, you know, contacts and stuff, I managed to learn a lot of the basics at a digital marketing agency in Budapest.
Cool.
And then since then, I spent, and growing up in Hungary, I was very far away from all the technical innovation, very far away from Silicon Valley.
Right.
I think until I was 15, 16, I thought Silicon Valley is where they made breast implants. That's not even a joke. I genuinely believe that.
It's probably true.
Yeah, maybe. And yeah, when I went to university, I started being more introduced to the kind of the entrepreneurial side of things. I started a company called Affairs Today, with two other people. We had the idea to create an international student journal.
Mm-hmm.
So every university has its own student journal, and we wanted to create an international one. We grew it with no budget, and when I say no budget, I mean we spent maybe $50 each. We grew it to almost 40,000 monthly readers.
Wow.
I was responsible for the website and the SEO and the promotions and also building up. So growth on the reader side, but also growth on the writer side. We grew to 120 writers. We interviewed everyone from the original creator of Skype through to the former king of Bulgaria.
Wow.
So we really tried to use our student puppy dog eyes to get as many interviews as possible. That was kind of my first venture into, you know, having my own startup, having my own company. And then after university, after doing two studies, I decided to go full-time into marketing. And then I went into affiliate marketing, agency marketing. And then I moved to Amsterdam 3 years ago to work as the lead trainer at Growth Tribe,
right.
Growth Tribe Academy.
Yep.
And then from there to Recruity, and now this summer to 3D Hubs.
Cool. And so you've been 3 years at Recruity?
Two. Yeah.
And when it started, how big was it when you started here?
When I joined, we were about 12, something like that.
Were you here already in this location?
We were not at this location,
okay,
yet. No, we were at the time in B Amsterdam.
Ah,
in the south. And yeah, I joined when there wasn't really a formalized marketing and growth setup. It was a company whose growth was very much driven by the product.
Mm.
And I was brought on board to essentially build the marketing and growth department up from the ground up. And yeah, since then we've more than quadrupled our revenue. We've grown to 70 people. I manage 14 people directly in the marketing and growth department.
14?
Yeah.
Wow.
And 8 months in, I was kind of, in quotation marks, promoted from head of growth to chief growth officer.
Wow.
So became more holistically involved in growth throughout the organization as well. And in that time, yeah, we pretty much quadrupled or fivefolded all of our metrics.
Wow.
On a bootstrap budget.
Very impressive. And I'm a Recruity user, because at OneFit we used Recruity.
Great. And, always good to hear.
Yeah, I love the product. And that's where I kind of got in touch, in contact with it for the first time. And so you started when there was 12 people and no marketeers,
mm,
I'm understanding. And
you
grew that to 14 marketeers. And
yes.
Can you talk a little bit about what that marketing department now looks like and why you grew it in a certain direction?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I joined, we Yeah, we had a little bit. We had a couple of all-rounder people, you know, kind of Swiss Army knife types,
right,
involved in various aspects, also partially marketing. And I really kind of made it my mission to really formalize things, build a strong team, strong structure, and a strong process. But of course, when you're starting out, you're only 12 people. You're past product market fit, but still trying to establish yourself in the market. Obviously, we didn't have the same kind of resources we have today. So I started out by hiring a growth marketer,
mm-hmm.
who, now that I'm leaving, is actually taking over as the head of growth at User Analytics,
okay.
or head of user growth and analytics, I
yep.
think, which is a really, probably, I would say, probably the biggest achievement is that I'm leaving and
the team is picking up. Position, yeah.
I think that's really great. And then from there on, I hired, so now at the moment we have two growth marketers. We have an events marketer, PR and communications manager, community builder, head of content and branding. We have a video marketing person. We have motion design, marketing design, brand design.
All in-house.
All in-house. And then we work with about 13 different freelancers in things like translations. We also have a localization manager and a product marketing manager in the team. We also first started building up business development as a in between the marketing and growth and the sales team.
Really
focus on lead generation. We've built the team out to essentially cover the whole range of possibilities in terms of customer acquisition, but also boosting customer activation.
Right. And Recruity is obviously, I think, a business to business SaaS product.
Yep.
And so you're selling mostly to companies,
yep.
right? Or freelance recruiters, maybe?
Almost entirely to companies. Sometimes, RPOs, in-housers, consultants as well. But
right. And can you tell me a little bit about what maybe the... obviously the goal was to grow very fast in an early stage startup. Mm-hmm. And what are some of the challenges that you ran into when you try to grow a business-to-business SaaS product?
Well, the challenges you face, especially because I always say that, heading up growth in an organization can mean so many different things, not only depending on the company, the industry, and the product you're talking about, but also just the stage at which you are. So getting from zero to X, getting your product market fit is one thing.
Yeah, and then that was already here,
and
right?
then establishing yourself, that was already here. We're in a very saturated market. There was already a lot of product validation. There was clearly a gap in the market for a very user-friendly, very scalable, very transparent solution. And especially in the European market, there was space to grow.
Because there was no competition?
There is competition, but the competition is very localized. So you'll have a competitor in Germany, you'll have competitors in France, but there's not really like the European player. There's a couple of players who are trying to establish themselves Europe-wide, but we really saw that there was a gap there. So the biggest challenge that we faced at the beginning was really breaking into higher levels, higher segments in the market. So you start out as the small solution with limited amount of features. So you focus on being user-friendly, being scalable, and being affordable. And then your audience is a lot of startups where you're not necessarily dealing with HR managers yet because they're small companies.
Yep.
And then as you expand, you need to start not only changing the product, but your messaging, your entire approach to marketing, to sales, to customer success needs to evolve as you break into the bigger markets and into the bigger companies. So when you go from startups to SMEs and then start breaking into the lower end of the corporate and enterprise spectrum, that was one specific challenge. Another one was really market expansion. I think market expansion and localization have been probably the biggest challenge, but also the biggest driver of our growth, in the sense that
geographic growth is always a quick win opportunity.
Exactly, but
yeah.
It's incredibly difficult, of course, because if you're in the States, you have 350, 330 million people there. You could 10x, 20x, 100x your company without ever having to translate a word. If you're in the Netherlands and then you're trying to expand into Germany, France, and the UK, you're already covering four different languages. Also knowing that not only are these four markets different linguistically, but they're completely different in terms of how evolved the market is. So you'll see that the Dutch market is significantly ahead of the German market, which is significantly ahead of the French market.
Mm.
So while you have, in one country, people asking for quite complex artificial intelligence related features, others are mind blown by a Kanban Trello style interface.
Right.
So you really need to start understanding how these different markets function, how you tackle them, and really what are the different kind of user profiles and personas you have in these different regions.
Right.
That was a big challenge as well.
Right. And so you started by yourself, and it was already localized in Holland, or was it?
Yes. So Dutch localization was already there.
Because it started with Holland was the initial market, right?
Yes, Holland was the initial
market.
Because
also a Polish founder and a Dutch founder.
Yes. We have two co-founders, one Dutch, one Polish. But from the beginning, in terms of the language and the presence, there was always the Dutch and then, let's say, the Anglo-centric international aspect.
Okay.
They grew simultaneously. And then I joined around the time that we started testing in the German market. So I was also helping with really pushing that forward. But of course, it's easier now. We have a localization manager. We have translators on retainer. Now we can really localize everything. But at the time, you're pulling resources from every department possible just to offer a minimum user experience in different languages.
And so would you say that in the beginning phases, the biggest effort or the biggest complication was that you just had to do most of it by yourself or with maybe a few hours here and there from colleagues? And that just doing it yourself is the growth hack? Or would you say that it's finding the processes ultimately that need to run in order to kind of consistently grow? What would you say?
I think it's both. I think ultimately it's the prioritization that becomes very complicated, right? Because what you find is that you can start testing these new markets, and after a while you start feeling a bit of pull effect.
Mm.
And then when you come to a point, and this happened in my case almost a year in, where you realize that, let's say you're working on website copy, and you'll spend 20, 30, 40 minutes, tweaking the beautiful copy, testing it, seeing what converts, both qualitatively and quantitatively. We do A/B testing, we also talk to people, and then you put so much love and effort into this English copy, and then you just chuck it into a translation. We didn't do any kind of machine-based translation,
no.
We actually used translators, but then you just translate it over, and then a lot of that gets lost in translation.
Yeah, the translator needs to be a marketeer almost, right?
Almost, and they're not.
No.
And if they are, you can't afford them in the early stages.
Yeah, exactly.
So what we realized is that we had to start, I learned a word about, a year ago, which was transcreation.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's common. The essence of what we found was really important,
yeah.
Which is, I'll give you one very specific example. We launched a whole kind of website and company rebrand in February.
Mm-hmm.
Where we said we want to distinguish ourselves from the old school, in quotation marks, applicant tracking system,
mm-hmm.
and move into what we call kind of a talent acquisition platform. Really thinking about, if you look at what companies in marketing automation, companies like HubSpot are doing, where they're really pulling together marketing, sales, and service into a suite of products, we really wanted to think about, okay, let's go beyond this traditional applicant tracking system, which is so associated with legacy tech,
mm-hmm.
And really start thinking about rebranding ourselves as a modern solution that is designed to accommodate all the future innovations from AI to automation to chatbots.
Right.
And that was very simple in English. But try to say talent acquisition platform in French and German, you can't. Not only that, you say talent acquisition platform to the UK audience or the US audience or to the Dutch audience and it resonates in this and it sparks their curiosity.
Yeah.
Whereas in Germany and France, people don't care about your innovative angle because they're not that far yet. They're still at the stage where they're questioning whether they should drop their spreadsheets or whether they should drop their legacy tech.
Right.
So there, we had to call ourselves recruitment software.
Right.
Or in French, logiciel de recrutement. We had to be very clear and say, that's what they're looking for.
Right, right, right.
So, and that's also part of this transcreation process where it's not enough to just figure out what works here and to try, like some stuff you can almost copy-paste, some stuff, but a lot of stuff you can't.
Right.
And that's where we really had to distinguish between what we saw as our market expansion strategy and then the individual strategy within each market.
Yeah. And so what you mentioned is that you did a rebranding beginning of this year, did you say that? I'm very curious about that because, from a growth hacking kind of background, which where I come from as well, rebranding is kind of like a dirty word. It's like you don't want to spend time and resource on it. I've come to the conclusion lately that probably rebranding or branding in general is is probably the final growth hack that you can do as a company, and it can be very powerful. Mm-hmm. So I'm very curious to see how you came to that idea to rebrand, and also how you approached it. How did you do it? How did you manage that? Yeah. Because you did it in-house, right? Rebranding.
Everything in-house.
No agency.
Within just a few months, yeah. Everything in-house.
Okay.
We don't rely too much on outsourcing, especially on the strategic side of things. Through various reasons. A simple one was means and resources.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is that we try to push as much in-house as possible. It's also, our software is designed on the basis that companies can take more control over their data by using our software rather than outsourcing to agencies, which of course in recruitment is something totally different than in other industries. So for the rebranding, I mean, I also come from a growth hacking background.
Right.
I don't use the word growth hacking ever.
No.
I've grown a little bit allergic to it.
Me too.
because what I found was that there's so much goodness in the modern approach to marketing, but you have so many people who forget the base principles. Storytelling, understanding your audience, the really core principles that have never really changed since the 50s,
Mad
even
Men.
Earlier. Yeah, exactly,
yeah.
Since Mad Men. The other thing is that there's nothing really that hacky, let's be honest. Most growth marketers are nowhere near as technical as they pretend to be. And what a lot of people are doing is gaining traction. And traction on growth is different, you know? If you have a brand new product and you're trying to get product market fit, it's great to do what you can to get 100, 200 people on the platform. But honestly, if you're trying to build a multi-million or multi-billion dollar company, you're going to be dealing with all kinds of different challenges. So I love the data-driven, experimental, lean mindset. And I think the growth hacking mindset is invaluable.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like over the years, it's also brought a lot of unwanted false dogma, pseudo-inspirational influencers and this kind of stuff. Branding, I totally agree, because for me, branding was always more of a blocker. It was,
yeah.
Oh, I want to ship this landing page and test this value proposition, but now I have to get it approved. So I totally agree. What I found, though, is especially through this journey here with Recruity, is that branding is incredibly important for a few reasons. The biggest one is there is so much content out there. There are so many companies out there that everywhere you look, there is complete saturation of every single channel, every single pixel of visual space is currently being occupied by something. Some company, some brand, some product that's trying to promote itself. And I think that ultimately, the more competitive your space, the more important your brand is going to be. Because you want to stand out. And one of the things that I found is that companies always overestimate how good their own product is.
Yeah.
You ask the founder of any company in the world, their product is not as good as they think. That doesn't mean the product's not good. It could be amazing. But founders always see it as better than they actually are.
Mm.
People are always biased by their own product.
Yeah.
And conversely, because it's painful to switch products, customers tend to overestimate how good their current products are as well.
Mm.
So how do you convince somebody to stay? How do I put this more simply? When you're trying to attract a customer who's using a competitor's solution, you always overestimate how good your product is and how aware the customer is or could be about how good your product is.
Right.
They usually don't have most of the information. In a B2B context, very often they don't even care as much as you do.
No.
You're building software, so you think software is the be-all and end-all. But maybe the person using the software doesn't care that much.
No.
You'll get recruiters and talent acquisition specialists who care a lot about the software. And then you get the ones who say, I don't even know the name of the system, and I log into it 10 times a day.
Mm.
We picked it because our manager said we should pick it. So what makes you stand out can often be the brand. The brand can really, I always think, like, you have a strong brand if theoretically somebody were to choose your product over a superior, equally priced product purely because of the story that you tell.
Right.
And that's a powerful brand. And I think there are companies that do this fantastically well. And a lot of companies that don't do it at all. And we were very much a product-first company, not a brand-first company.
And
so
most startups are, right? Because they come from a product idea.
Most, yes.
And then they forget that the product ultimately can change.
Yeah.
But the brand should probably do the selling, right?
Exactly. And there's a lot of companies that are still companies that also start with a very strong brand and have no product whatsoever. And they suffer more in the long run.
That's true.
So in our case, we really focus on building the best product we could. and putting a very uniquely high quality product on the market.
But do you feel, because I see this at a lot of scale-ups, tech scale-ups, is that because they're so good, ultimately after like a few years, they turn into great product teams, right? Especially if they have some success initially, and then the process of the improving the product becomes such a train that's hard to stop. And so they're constantly improving the product, creating new features. Whereas sometimes the product is good and you don't need to change it. And you just need
Absolutely.
To fix your brand or your storytelling about the great product. Right?
Yeah, I think this falls into the wider issue, which is that people love micro-optimizing things even when there's bigger fish to fry.
Right.
There's such a culture around optimization and data and experimentation. I think that's fantastic. I think it's hugely important, and most companies in the world are nowhere near as good as they need to be.
Right.
However, there's now this kind of other extreme where people are, you know, I like to call it, you know, shuffling chairs before an earthquake. You know, it's great. You know, you shouldn't pour water into a leaky bucket, but if you don't have any water in sight, what's the point of fixing the leaks in the bucket? Maybe you should find the water first. It's the same thing with the product. There'll come a point where the smaller UX fixes will have bigger value for your customers than a huge new feature rollout, which nobody even asked for. The same thing is, there'll come a point where working on your brand might actually have a bigger impact than improving your product.
Yeah.
Now, we have a very feature-heavy product, you know, 80 plus features, and it's a really, really important part of every kind of recruitment or hiring team's tool stack. So we haven't gotten to that point yet. But we did realize that brand would have a big impact, because there's so many competitors and they all call themselves the same thing and they all say we're the most user-friendly and we're the best for the GDPR and we're the best for this and the best for that, and we do employer branding. When everyone's saying the same thing, already just saying something slightly different is already going to help you stand out.
Right.
And more importantly, it's one thing, the way that we use branding very practically speaking is, it's one thing, We try to differentiate between lead generation and demand generation. On the one hand, lead generation is, there's a bunch of people who have a pain, they're looking for a solution, and you're trying to tap into those people and get them, leverage them towards your product.
Yeah.
Demand generation is really about creating the next generation of solution seekers, where we're thinking about, what are the people who are not currently feeling the pain or not aware of the pain?
Like shaping the market.
Essentially,
yeah.
Or even expanding the market by pulling more people into the sphere. So you've got companies like, let's take something completely different. Take a company like Tesla, right? Look at how many people have Teslas and how many people love Tesla. It's a huge amount of people love Tesla.
Yeah, right.
And then you will eventually, if you build a very strong brand and you build a strong audience, it doesn't even matter if 70% of that audience aren't potential customers, because they create buzz and they create momentum, which gets you press mentions.
Yeah.
It gets you referrals.
Of course. Yeah.
It gets your name out there. Because the way that most people buy products is that they realize they need something, and then they do a little bit of exploration, and that ranges from really in-depth research, but most people don't do that much in-depth research.
No.
Most people, what we found is that when they're looking for a recruitment software, they'll say, let's just take a CRM, for example. They say, we need a new CRM. What are the ones you've heard of? Salesforce, HubSpot, Agile. Cool, let's just research those three.
Right.
And if you're not the one of those three or four names that pops up in their mind,
mental availability,
you're out.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter how good you are. Even if you're on the first on Google sometimes, it won't even matter, because not everyone makes decisions so in-depth and so well-researched as you expect. So having a strong brand presence, having a big audience of promoters and followers who love your brand, and that's challenging. I mean, the recruitment tech space is niche.
Yeah.
And we still managed to carve out
because of
thought leadership position.
I'm very curious because... Well, you obviously understand this aspect, but how did you sell that internally? Because building brand and identity is expensive, right? You need a lot of people usually, especially if you do it in-house, and you have those like community builders, brand people, and maybe the professional content creators. You somehow managed to create the leverage for you to spend that budget on that. And how is that? Is that because the founders also thought that way, or did you convince them somehow with this?
Well, first of all, I've had the very fortunate situation of having a lot of trust from the beginning.
Yeah.
And I've been allowed to pursue my plans and ideas without too much resistance and without having to evangelize too much. Second of all, I think it's different people will react differently. So there'll be people who'll be on board with the whole branding thing, and branding is a broad term, you know.
Yeah.
For some people branding is just design.
Something else,
for some people branding is just, you know. For us, the branding is all about really like building, telling our story and building a strong, so we want our brands to have a large reach, high recognition, and high level of favorability. Those are the three things we measure in brand. Because
yep.
a lot of companies have big reach, big recognition, but not favorable.
Right.
So Uber, for example,
right,
suffers from it a lot.
They get a lot of
they get a lot of flack. Even when they don't do anything bad,
no.
they still get shit on
social media.
Yeah. So what we did is we made sure that the people, the stakeholders who would be most resistant to it, understood that we had their priorities in mind. So for example, having very strong sales and marketing alignment was really important. As long as the sales team knows that you're focusing on generating leads, they're not going to worry too much about you focusing time on branding.
Yeah.
However, if you don't talk, if you don't communicate, and if you don't align, it's very easy for somebody who's closing leads to say, why are you writing this kind of wishy-washy top-level article that doesn't really, how does that relate to me closing a deal?
Right.
And that's completely understandable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the important thing is to communicate and really explain the strategy. So the way that we look at it is that we have this entire lead generation machine, which is one side, the automated side, the other side, the business development driven, you know, hands-on human side.
Yep.
And for us, imagine that's the bucket. And everything we do in content and branding is the water.
That falls into it.
Exactly.
Right, right, yeah.
And we went through great lengths to explain that. Then in terms of resources, we started small.
Mm-hmm.
Where could you create the most value? Where's the gap? If everybody's written this same ebook about the same topic, we're not going to focus on that. Right? An ebook takes this and this much time to write, and you can get the same value with a webinar. We just realized that if you have 3,000 customers, you have a great community of experts that you can leverage, and you can crowdsource content, and you can crowdsource ideas. So we started small, and then we just scaled it up. That's how, at the beginning, we did one meetup. The first meetup we ever did was here in the office. We had a brand new office with a great space, and there was this existing HR meetup, and they said they were looking for a space. We said, well, how about this? You guys come to our space, we give you the space for free, we'd love to have a speaker on the meetup, and we'll provide the drinks. And that allowed us to essentially validate it without taking any responsibility, time, or effort into it. Now we're at a point where we're running meetups monthly, and we even just did our first meetup in Berlin, where we fly people over to Berlin, and we work with a local customer in Berlin who provided the space, and we do it all in a very lean way. Same thing for the website rebrand, because I know you asked that earlier, and we drifted off. You just need to start with a very core alignment of what do you want to achieve? What is the goal of the rebrand? The problem that happens very often is that a lot of people have a lot of different ideas and they run in different directions, and then they sink about 100 hours before they realize they're not on the same page. So we said from the very beginning that we wanted to have a core idea of what is the goal of this rebrand? How is it going to look? And then we made kind of a skeletal outline of what this is going to be, key value propositions, the angles. So now we have, you know, the talent acquisition platform. Everything's broken down. Features are broken down into attract, automate, predict. So this was something that our CEO put forward as an idea. We built upon it. And then we sourced ideas and information from the whole company, where everyone could contribute thoughts and ideas. Then we tried to pull it together, make something out of it. I actually wrote the entire content of the website in 3 days myself, 9,000 words, because at the time, in terms of combining product knowledge, content writing, and SEO, I was best placed to do that.
Right.
So just powered through it, and then we brought on all kinds of different people from different teams to give feedback, to help improve, to help perfect it.
And so you changed a lot of, and what I'm noticing is you guys have a strong focus on copy, right? And it's a rational product, it's a business product, so copy is very important. Different languages, copy is very important.
Yeah.
What about the visual elements, like logo or style, or did you touch that?
All of this, yeah. Well, so I worked very closely with our chief experience officer, who's a product designer. He did a lot of the design side of things.
Right.
But we aligned super closely. So when you look at the animations and the visuals, I oversaw the creation of all of that. And I also gave the first round of design feedback. The CEO and myself gave the first round of design feedback to all website designs.
Wow.
And a lot of the elements I also pitched myself. So,
right.
For example, when you have kind of the drop-down clickables, which changes the animations and stuff on the website, I contributed all those things.
And
there
so,
as well.
So you know, I would consider you, you know, very analytical for seniors. You grow have a big growth background. You know all the technical growth, automation tricks, but apparently you also have a very strong creative developed side. Then, right? Would you see it that way, or?
Yes, but it's something built over time. It wasn't natural.
Yeah, you didn't go to school for it or anything like that, right?
I went to school for political science.
Right.
So
that's funny.
Nothing to do with what I do.
Yeah, that's fair. That's cool. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's very interesting. I kind of want to switch to the closing question, and that is, you mentioned you pulled everything in house, and you know we see that trend everywhere, especially in tech scale-ups. They like to build their own in-house agency. Somehow I think it's usually not a cost thing, because ultimately that's also very costly, but it does give you kind of like ownership over maybe the process or over the brain trust that you were building when you pulled that in-house. What kind of, we mentioned, you know, the Mad Men times, you know, the agency world, where, you know, I've kind of explored the agency world in the Netherlands a little bit, and you know, there's some really fantastic creative agency to have, like the top level creative geniuses of Holland working there. However, they don't understand anything about growth or performance marketing or anything like that. And of course, then there's the big performance marketing agencies. You know, you probably know them, the Blue Mangoes and the Depths and all that guys. Where do you see, I mean, and they're disconnected from the creative element, right? So they're really good at analytics and optimizing, but they are very poor, in my estimation, in creative development.
Yeah.
And you obviously saw that too, because you did that yourself. And so you solved that by figuring out yourself. Where do you see a room or a future for agencies in general? How do you see that? Or is there a future for agencies? Or is it like they're going to disappear, but they're all going to do in-house agencies, which, you know, as far as I'm concerned, is a possibility?
Yeah. Well, the agency question is a difficult one. I mean, I started my career in an agency.
Right. What kind of agency was it?
It was a digital marketing agency. Standard.
So performance, performance focused.
Everything. Performance, social, web design, SEO.
Right.
But very much performance focused,
yeah,
for smaller clients. It's difficult because I generally, if people see like the talks that I give, I'm generally not too kind towards agencies.
Yeah.
The reason for this is not because I don't have something fundamentally against agencies. Of course, I worked at Growth Tribe, which is the culture of, you know, teach, don't outsource.
Mm-hmm.
Now I work at Recruity, which is, you know, like do it yourself with tech, don't outsource. So that is, I'm definitely biased in that respect. But what I think is that the main issue is just there are amazing agencies out there, really, really amazing agencies and great consultancies. But for every great agency, there's probably 100 really mediocre ones.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And on a global level, it's even worse, you know. So in the Netherlands, you actually have quite a high amount of really good agencies. I think ultimately, I have no idea how agencies will evolve or how they need to evolve. What I think is ultimately, it comes down to is that there are three things that companies have to own. The first thing is data. The second thing is process. And the third thing is culture and brand or story, however you want to call it. You want to own the data, the process, and the culture around your activities. So in the recruitment space, that means you need to know the data, right? Maybe you can even add a fourth one, the network in recruitment. That's not necessarily going to be the case in other fields. But you need the data in order to understand what's happened and in order to optimize for the future. That's vital. You want to be able to instill your brand, your story, your culture into whatever's being done. So this falls exactly into the example that you gave with the performance marketing agencies, that very often you'll have these ads that might get a better click-through rate, but they don't guarantee that once the salesperson gets someone on the phone that those expectations have been well managed and that that actually closes.
Right.
I actually made that mistake right at the beginning when I started. I shifted a big chunk of ads budget to the United States because the costs, all metrics just were so much better. And then our head of sales came to me and said, no, don't target the American leads because we have 20 competitors there.
Mm.
And by the time we get on the phone with them in sales, our chance of closing them is way lower than a lead based in Europe.
Right.
So then you might have halved the cost per click, but the cost per lead is double.
Right.
And that's something that agencies, if they're not fully embedded in your organization, will struggle with quite a lot. Now it's different, of course, if all you're looking for is a better cost per click to satisfy your manager or something, then that's fine. But on a holistic level, losing ownership of the data makes you very dependent. And if you can't build your own processes around it, it's difficult. So we tend to outsource a lot of the legwork.
Mm-hmm.
So if we want to write an article, we'll map out the core ideas, we'll do the basic SEO, we'll make a skeletal outline, and then we'll hire someone to write it. We try to keep the strategic side in-house. So I think the future of agencies will really be how well can they embed themselves into the current operational side of an organization. So in the recruitment world, it's RPOs, for example. Recruitment consultants who come in-house.
Yeah.
They set up the tools for you.
Yeah.
They make sure that you own the data. Because for me, the scariest thing is if you have an agency that does... We recently worked with an SEO agency. I won't name them because it wouldn't be particularly kind. But they were supposedly the very best SEO agency in the country. Not here in the Netherlands. And you could just tell that we were one of the smaller clients. We got way less attention than what we should have gotten. And they would make recommendations which were very short-sighted. So they would say, you have to do this because it's, you know, sometimes you make a choice and you have to decide between a technical branding and SEO factor.
Right.
So for example, we made the kind of tragic or drastic move of putting our blog on a subdomain.
Famous.
Which a lot of people said was nightmare for SEO. Now our blog traffic is actually 5 times higher than it was. We did it for technical reasons.
Right.
Because the way that everything was set up, I needed my team to be able to edit and change and optimize the blog whenever. Because ultimately that was more important. And then when you're dealing with an agency that's only focused on SEO, for example, they would say, well, if you don't do it our way, we can't guarantee a result.
Right,
and that's a problem because the responsibility and the accountability just isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
So the better agencies will embed themselves in the organizations. That doesn't mean they have to be in-house necessarily.
Mm.
It's just about embedding themselves
in
a way.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I know, of course, agencies aren't going to come and guarantee results.
Well, there are some big, very big agencies like DDB or Focus or shifting their focus and saying, okay, we guarantee performance and we will be paid based on performance. So I do see that trend happening.
And that's an interesting one because it means really it's much more difficult. But if you can actually make a name for yourself in that way, then it puts you in a really unique position. It's really just about, like, it's all a machine, right? All of marketing and growth, it's so intertwined with everything else.
Yeah.
You can spend all your day optimizing your user activation, but if your customer success reps are insulting customers on the phone, you're going to lose more than you gain.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's all connected and it's all embedded. So I'm a big proponent of holistic approaches to marketing and growth. And I think agencies who can fit into that are going to do very well. And I think the agencies that can't fit into that are not going to... I think they'll always survive because there's always going to be people who don't understand enough to be able to distinguish.
But there are a lot of agencies, so they're probably not all going to survive, I think.
Not all, no.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ferdinand. It was very interesting. And
thank you.
Thanks.